Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Bartley, and to my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today in the matter of Molitor v. Shulkin, docket number 152585. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Li Vu Ndo, and to my left is Senior Appellate Attorney Thomas Polsino, representing the appellant Jacqueline Molitor.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, this is the court. My name is Shereen Marcus, and I represent the Secretary in this matter. With the State Counsel's table is Deputy Chief Counsel Christopher Wallace.
Okay, thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed? Okay, each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. I'd like to focus on the duty to assist and the adequate statement of reason and basis in this oral argument. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Davis, and may it please the court. The board erred in this case because it failed to satisfy the duty to assist by not obtaining third-party records, and even more so, the board erred because it failed to provide an adequate statement of reasons or bases for why it did not need to obtain those records in this case. And further, because this was reasonably raised by the record, this is something that the board had to address. The board at no point responded to appellant's request when she named specific service members who she believed had also been raped and also named service members who witnessed the attack and also participated in it, specifically Sergeant Thomas or Thompson, who she said she struck back during the attack. Therefore, the service records, particularly of Sergeant Thomas or Thompson, are relevant in this case because any treatment records he had from the time of the incident would show any injuries he sustained at that time.
Counsel, what is the impact of the overall credibility issues in this case with these facts and on the duty to assist?
Well, first, Your Honor, appellant disagrees with the board's finding of a negative credibility. The board provided an inadequate statement of reasons or bases as to her credibility by saying, first, because they did not consider appellant's statements that her medication had an effect on her memory. In addition, Cindy McCauley, her therapist, who said that there's a pattern of memories resurfacing later at a time, is consistent with the memories of her childhood abuse also surfacing later. And in that way, also, further, appellant contends that the board can't make this negative credibility finding until they have a complete record. These records that appellant is requesting could substantiate her claim, which would change the credibility finding. So the board needs to first satisfy the duty to assist or at least address it before it can make that negative finding.
Well, as I look through the record here, counsel, there are some fantastic facts that are set out in a lot of different ways, and including statements that indicate the appellant habitually lies and is not sure why that happens. So I'm trying to assess how the initial credibility issues would impact on the secretary's duty to, if the language I recall in the regulation is to make reasonable efforts to assist, right? And is it reasonable, given this factual context, to attempt to find people that may or may not exist? At this point, we don't know, right?
Well, Your Honor, appellant has named at least 9 different people, and it wouldn't be a large search that the VA would have to do. We already know she was in the 284th Company, she was in the 5th Battalion, she was in the 4th Platoon, she was in the 4th Squad, so we're narrowing it down to a very small number of people. So if JSRC did a search for those names, even though they're only last names, it'd be pretty easy to pull that list and see if those people exist, and then from there go on to obtain her consent to request their records, and then each of those service members' consent.
Would the duty to assist only involve requesting records, or could it be something short of that?
In this case, because of the privacy concerns, if the VA at least obtains consent from both parties and receives a response from both parties, that would satisfy reasonable efforts in this case.
Could those people be contacted to provide witness statements regarding the incident?
VA does not.
Records?
Pursuant to the duty to assist, VA does not have a specific obligation to obtain statements or subpoenas, just their records. And, of course, if they received a negative response from JSRC, either in regards to their names or a negative consent response, then that would also satisfy the duty to assist. And at the very least, Your Honor, the board has not even addressed this issue. In her fairly large claims file, it has never come up. VA has never responded, even though at 287 she specifically says, please review this person's autopsy. Please see if this person had any behavior indications. Please note that I beat up this other person. At no point has VA said, no, we can't get those records because, or yes, we will get those records. So at this point, we need to at least remand for the board to provide reasons or bases as to whether the duty to assist has been satisfied in this instance.
Would you have been satisfied if VA had responded?
If VA had responded.
Would you be here if VA had responded? Look, we've asked for it, or we are making our preliminary judgment on credibility, and we don't think we should go on a fishing expedition. What more did you want?
Well, Your Honor, if VA had responded as to why they could not get the records, that would definitely be a really good start, something that they did not do here. Also, as to the second part of the question, if they responded saying no because there has been a negative credibility finding, that would at least give appellant a chance to explain some of the credibility issues, specifically the effects on because of her medication, how it is consistent with how she remembered the sexual trauma for her childhood, and other behavior indicators such as discharging early due to pregnancy is what the record states, but presumably because this other service member who she believes had also been raped committed suicide. So that part would at least be answered and give her a response to resolve those issues so that she can get these records.
Counsel, is there any VA regulation or any case on the duty to assist and when it may stop? And this goes to the question of whether VA, if your allegations are correct, that they should have undertaken to do the kind of development described in, is it 15-4 or 4-15? What's the GC opinion?
5-2014.
Oh, 5-14. Okay. The 5-14 GC opinion. So is there any VA reg or case that talks about the duty to assist stopping or starting, maybe depending on credibility or otherwise?
So 3.159C, Your Honor, at least states that they have to make reasonable efforts, especially if it's evidence that's necessary to substantiate the claim, and then also a relevancy finding. So the government would have to at least make those three findings and address those three concerns before finding that the government did not have to obtain the records, which was not done in this case. So the government has not met even that minimal threshold that's always existed in duty to assist law.
Well, how do any of these records help to support the claim?
So the records of Sergeant Thomas or Thompson, since she said that she did strike him back, his service records from that time, if they showed physical injuries, that would help corroborate her claim. In addition, the records of Private Lutz, Angel, Wendell, and Jones, if they had any indicators that they were also raped, because she said that this is something that happened as part of an initiation ceremony, then that shows that this is probably something that was a pattern within this unit and within this platoon, so that would also corroborate her claim.
Anything else?
So personnel records as well, Your Honor, would show any behavioral changes of both other women who were attacked and any witnesses who were there at the time. Appellant states that there are at least 6 or 7 people who were there during this quote-unquote ceremony.
Well, is there a minimum threshold, for example, that the veteran has to make here? Like, I've got the statements of my colleagues who you've just mentioned or former members of the same squad. You're down to the squad level now, right?
At least the platoon level, yes, Your Honor.
Would you think the veteran should come forward with something more than here, than
well,
a name or
yes,
possibility?
Well, the problem in the appellant's case specifically is she was part of the military police unit. So VA already has a lower threshold for obtaining evidence in MST cases. But in this case, it's particularly difficult because she had no one to report to. Her rapists and attackers were part of the military police unit. And so, in addition, VA is most able to obtain these records, as the OGC opinion touches on slightly. It would be hard for appellant herself to get these records because she would first have to have the information of where these people are located, how to contact them. In addition, she would be reaching out and revealing too much of her own information. So these are records that really makes the most sense for VA to have to obtain these records.
What would VA do, assuming that it had the obligation to go find the personnel records of these other soldiers? What would they be telling the soldiers about the purpose for their inquiry?
So VA could, Your Honor, tell each of the service members the purpose of the inquiry as long as they redact appellant's information, because we want appellant to be protected as well. So if nothing was known but her name and the very brief overview of the claim, she's filing an MST claim, full stop, then that would be enough. And then in their response, they would also be told, of course, that their information would also be redacted. So there's no risk of these two sides running into each other, any conflict, because that information would be redacted. Any addresses, social security numbers, she already knows their names, so of course that would be fine. But they would be, the third-party members would be allowed to know at least her name.
Well, what if the VA had, in an elaborate and detailed fashion, outlined all the reasons why, matters of privacy, hearsay considerations, credibility considerations that you can't make based on paperwork alone. What if it had spelled all of this out? Is there anything more we can do for you?
Well, Your Honor, if the VA...
Essentially a failure to give adequate reasons and bases for the VA's lack of action. Or is it something more than that, more substantive than that?
Yes and no, Your Honor. And VA has not given her any explanation at all. So that is the main reason that appellant is here today. But if VA had at least responded to her, to appellant's request by saying why it could not get these records, or even encouraging her to, if she knew VA could not get these records since she did ask, then the VA would at least encourage appellant to attempt to obtain these records. She did not have that chance here. If the board also had addressed it, then reasons or bases could have been satisfied. It's unsure at this point because, you know, appellant doesn't know what the board exactly would have said since the board didn't address it at all. So at the very least, remand is necessary so that the board can do that. The board, you know, as the fact finder, needs to, in the first instance, decide whether the duty to assist was satisfied, and if not, to either remand her case back down to regional office or to provide a reason why the board cannot get those records.
Thank you.
Counsel, given the resources that are involved at the VA with developing claims along the lines of duty to assist and meeting those responsibilities, is it possible, given the factual record here, that a decision was made that perhaps these alleged witnesses didn't even exist?
Well, Your Honor, if VA did make that determination that these service members did not exist, VA would have to at least tell appellant that. There was no notice under 3.1590. You have to at least give, and F as well, you have to at least give notice of why you cannot obtain these records, of why the government, all the efforts that they made. For instance, there is a formal finding in the record that was provided to appellant. It, of course, does not include anything about obtaining third-party records and responding to her requests, but that would at least put appellant on notice of the efforts that were made and the decision VA made. At this point, no one knows what VA's decision was other than, based on this record, that they did not make a decision and just ignored that request.
Well, when I look at the board opinion, there are an awful lot of findings here regarding credibility. And I might direct your attention to page 18 to start of the board decision, the record before the agency, page 16 of the board decision itself. And the board discusses a lot of inconsistencies and indicates that the veteran described events in service during her June 2004 VA examination that the examiner said did not meet the criteria for PTSD, but following denial of her claim later the same month, then the veteran's story changed, subsequently reported that she had been sexually abused and or assaulted in Germany during her active service period. And as I go through the board's decision, there are numbers of findings regarding inconsistency in statements and testimony, including when the alleged second rape occurred. It was 3 hours in one statement to a examiner. It was during the summer of 1986 in another. And you have the veteran's own words that she lies and doesn't know why. So there are credibility findings here, and it really makes me wonder if it certainly is perhaps the reason why the board did not discuss the alleged attackers.
Well, Your Honor, appellant respectfully disagrees with the board's credibility finding as a whole. In the later section of appellant's brief, appellant does contend that the board's credibility finding itself also lacks reasons or bases, especially based on the evidence from her counselor, Cindy McCauley, who says that the memories resurface later, so that's not inconsistent with later being able to provide more details. Appellant has been working with a therapist to help bring back the repressed memories, the not surprisingly repressed memories, given the incident itself. And so because appellant disagrees with the credibility finding, you know, adequate reasons or bases are needed for a proper credibility finding. And in addition, the board can't make a credibility finding until it has a complete record, which it both doesn't have and didn't explain why it did not attempt to obtain. In addition, going back to the question about the VA's resources, again, the record is very specific about the names, the platoon. It's not a lot of records that we're asking the VA to search for here. A JSRC response, even if it came back negative, that would at least be helpful and at least provide a more full record for the board to make a proper credibility finding.
Was there any development undertaken, i.e. a JSRC request, after Ms. Molitor's memories of rape instead of sexual harassment, after those resurfaced, was there any JSRC request at all or any attempt to develop the incidents that she's alleging?
from
I know there was the 2004, I think it was, was in October 2004, AMC finding signed by a JSRRC coordinator, but afterwards, after she made the rape allegations?
In April 2012, there was a formal finding on the lack of information to corroborate the stressor. I believe it's at page 309 of the record. And because that was in April 2012, she actually provided more names after that date. In April 2013, the sexual trauma markers is where appellant provided her company, her battalion, her platoon, as well as additional names. So since the time those names have been provided and she's requested a search of those records, there has not been another formal finding, Your Honor.
Very quickly, counsel, your time is about to expire, but I'm curious, what cases do you believe this case may be guided by? Is this a case that's close to Forcier or to Patton or to Hyatt or to Faust?
First, Your Honor, while not precedential, the Durham case does show that VA is aware that that VA can obtain third-party records. So because of that case, it was at least reasonably raised and something that should have been addressed. And then in Godwin v. Derwinski, the court found that VA has to at least respond to requests that the appellant makes, especially specific requests like in this case.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. The secretary here maintains that the court should affirm the board's May 2015 decision on appeal as adequate statement of reasons or bases were provided and the duty to assist was complied with. Turning to the questions posed in the court's December 2016 order asking whether the duty to assist may encompass obtaining third-party records or at least informing an appellant why no such efforts will be undertaken where records are adequately identified and may corroborate a stressor. The answer is, Your Honors, yes. In those circumstances, there may be cases where VA would have to undertake those efforts or provide such notice, but those circumstances do not apply here. For the duty to assist to be triggered under 5103A, three considerations must be met. First, records have to be adequately identified. Second, the records have to be relevant and raise a reasonable possibility of substantiating the claim. And third, even if those first two prongs are met, the efforts necessary for VA to obtain those records must be within the scope of reasonableness. Here, no third-party records were adequately identified, and the claimant did not demonstrate the relevancy of any potential third-party record, and therefore the board was not legally obligated to reach the third prong or otherwise assess the reasonableness of obtaining such hypothetical records in this case.
The counsel, the names of people who were present at the alleged attack were provided, were they not?
Yes, Your Honor, and providing names is not the same thing as adequately identifying records. In Loving v. Nicholson, the court explained this first prong further, explaining that the claimant has to specify what it is he or she wants VA to obtain and for what purpose. Vague assertions are not enough. The possible existence of a record is not enough. Rather, there has to be sufficient information for VA to actually locate a record. Now
didn't she say that she attacked Sergeant Thomas/Thompson and that something about he would have been treated? As a matter of fact, I think she said she beat him up.
Correct. So the October 2012 statement says that she identifies an assailant as Sergeant Thomas or Sergeant Thompson. And those happen to be two different names. They also happen to be very common names. And she indicates that I'm trying to see the exact quote because I don't want to misquote her, that she started hitting him. This is not an identity of a record. Now, I understand in the brief, appellant is now trying to cure this defect, but as the court held in Loving v. Nicholson, curing the defect in a brief before the court on appeal is not the same thing as identifying records before the agency. Looking solely at these statements, they're just vague assertions of a possible existence of something and just a mere listing of names. In fact, the October 2012 statement indicates that she wants VA to try and locate the named men and women. Well, that's clearly outside the duty to assist, as the VA is obligated to obtain outstanding records that are relevant and raise a reasonable possibility of substantiating a claim. Secretary is not under an obligation to locate people or depose people.
Would it help to confirm or verify the existence of people in the unit? As appellant's counsel pointed out, there was a fairly narrow area of search if, in fact, those people were members of the MP unit, then it seems as though you could determine whether or not those names actually existed or didn't.
Well, that would be inconsistent with the holding in Lam v. Shinseki. It's not the Secretary's responsibility to act as a private investigator. Nothing would have precluded the appellant from looking at her own unit records and refreshing her own memory as to what the exact names were or who they were. Keep in mind that we're talking about veterans' privacy, and the VA has an obligation to protect those third-party veterans. When there's no possible understanding of what it is she wants VA to obtain or for what purpose.
Well, I can appreciate that you're making this argument, but the fact is that the board didn't address the GC opinion at all, and the GC opinion contemplates actions being taken on a case-by-case basis. Why didn't the board address that?
Yes, Your Honor. The board did not address the GC opinion, but it is the Secretary's contention that it was not triggered. That analysis was not triggered here because those first two prongs were not met. The GC opinion discusses a case-by-case determination and factors to consider within the scope of the third element, the third prong in assessing the reasonableness of VA undertaking efforts to obtain these records. But where records have not been adequately identified and where the claimant has not demonstrated a relevancy or a reasonable possibility of those records substantiating the claim, the board would have no obligation or reason to assess reasonableness in this case. Even if we look at these third-party statements and try to construe some record from these statements, which the Secretary maintains just simply isn't there, the inquiry would still have to move on to the second prong, which is those third-party records would have to be relevant and raise a reasonable possibility of substantiating the claim.
Now, I think that Ms. Molitor made pretty specific claims that PFC Lutz committed suicide. Do you think that any records that show that indeed she did commit suicide, or that there was any investigation about it that might have shown a rape, if there were those records, would that help support her claim?
No, Your Honor. The claimed stressor here, the missing information in the appellant's claim, is the claimed stressors that occurred to her, the rape that occurred to her. She's not indicating that she has any actual knowledge of this person being raped or committing suicide. She's not claiming that that is the reason why she currently has PTSD. The fact that somebody else may have been raped does not have any relevancy.
Well, I'm finding it hard to believe that if there were information that women in this squad were repeatedly raped, and men possibly, that there was a rape initiation culture, that wouldn't be relevant to proving a particular rape claim?
That wouldn't be relevant in this particular case because the appellant, first of all, is not indicating any actual knowledge. She's simply just saying here's some women who happen to be stationed here at the same time.
But she did make claims that other people were raped, or that this that they had told her that this happens to everyone or select few.
Right, but these vague assertions are exactly what the court addressed in Gauber v. Jerwinski, where the duty to assist cannot be used as a license for a fishing expedition. These vague assertions that don't have any bite to it, any actual knowledge to it, and asking VA to just search highly sensitive private information on the sheer guess that there might be something in somebody else's records is clearly outside the duty to assist. In Ragas v. Shinseki, furthermore, the court held that there must be a specific and a credible reason for believing that the identified records would contain the relevant information. This, as well as the statute and the regulation, clearly indicate that there is an umbrella of credibility that hangs over all of the prongs of the duty to assist. The regulation, 3.159, subsection D, specifically says that VA should discontinue and refrain from further assistance where there is no reasonable possibility of substantiating the claim. This court and the federal...
And that regulation also talks about three different circumstances under which the duty to assist development could be discontinued. Can you just... It gives three examples, but it's not limited to those three examples. Can you just go over those three examples?
Sure. Hang on one moment. So the three examinations, Your Honor, and as you indicated, they're not an exhaustive list, includes the claimant's ineligibility for the benefit sought because of a lack of qualifying service, lack of veteran status, or lack of legal eligibility. Claims that are inherently incredible or clearly lack merit, and an application requesting a benefit to which the claimant is not entitled as a matter of law.
Now, the second example there, claims that are inherently incredible, appears to go to possibly halting, where a halting or not engaging in the duty to assist development, where the appellant's claims are inherently incredible. So it goes to credibility, the credibility of the claim.
Yes,
is VA, does VA believe that her claims are inherently incredible?
VA is not making a hard and fast rule with regard to this specific claim. Inherent credibility may suggest something that is even further than just a credibility determination. However, it is the Secretary's position that at a bare minimum, the board's thorough analysis from record at page 17 through record at page 21, over four pages of analysis detailing her lay statements and why they were deemed not credible in this case, serves as sufficient notice as to why no further development was going to be undertaken in her case.
Well, I think Appellant also argues that under Daves versus Nicholson, I believe it was, that the board erred in doing that credibility determination because it didn't talk about attempts she had made to explain inconsistencies and try and rehabilitate her credibility.
The Secretary respectfully disagrees. The court did address her explanations at record at page 18 to 19. The board specifically addressed that appellant claimed that she had repressed memories that were coming back in bits and pieces. The board also went through, I mean, this is a very complicated case, and the board walked us through that, explained the childhood abuse and how those were repressed memories. Keep in mind that at this point of the board's decision, the appellant has received six duty to assist letters, has received five VA medical opinions to include three in-person VA examinations, and has provided testimony at two board hearings. The board went through
if only quantity sufficed over quality.
Right, and the board explained that the examiners, all five of them, found her progressive exaggeration and dramatic quality as to the symptoms simply not credible to support the military trauma. In contrast, it did support that there was the childhood abuse. And the difference was explained by the examiners and accepted by the board as persuasive, which is that repressed memories usually add detail and provide some missing information. But the exact character of the assaults progressively exaggerated and changed throughout time, and that is what the examiners found not credible and the board found persuasive. The board also noted VA outpatient treatment records as well as vet center records that where the appellant conceded she wasn't sure if her memories were real and that she conceded she lied to at least one VA examiner. The board addressed the testimony at the hearings where she described the violent nature of these assaults and the injuries that she incurred, including to her back, which were inconsistent with service treatment records from around the same time period that don't even incidentally mention any kind of head wounds or bruises or any of that sort. Plus, there were Social Security disability records that clearly indicated she injured her back after service in an occupational setting with no prior history of back trouble or back injuries, and she's currently getting disability benefits for that injury. For all those reasons, the board concluded that all of appellant's lay statements were rejected as simply not credible. And at the bare minimum, that serves as sufficient notice as to why no further assistance was going to be undertaken to verify these stressors. Now, the GC opinion 5-2014 explains that the Privacy Act and FOIA, as well as VA's own privacy regulations, generally prohibit disclosure of third-party records. Circumventing those things or trying to find an applicable exception where at the bare minimum appellant has not adequately identified records and has not demonstrated the relevancy of any such records and how it would reasonably substantiate her claim wasn't warranted here. There was no obligation upon the VA to assess the reasonableness of such a request in this case.
Counsel, I appreciate your focus on the duty to assist in the context of records, but I believe that the regulation goes a little bit beyond only records. As I read the patent case, as I read 4CA, the duty to assist would include in the process of identifying potential sources, if a claimant provides a name or names of people who allegedly perpetrated an assault, or names of any potential witnesses, the Secretary's reasonable efforts to assist are required to be provided under 5103A. So we're not just talking about records. And in this case, we do have names that were provided. And is it really a fishing expedition when not only are the names provided, but you can identify the unit that the service member is in, and at least, you know, the waters in which you're fishing perhaps are limited to several fish in one particular area. Doesn't that make this a little bit easier to carry your analogy further?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but I still would characterize this particular circumstance as a fishing expedition, simply because the normal markers that VA looks for to verify the stressors are something that were searched within her own private records, within her own military records, and were found absent. Appellant conceded she never reported the incident, never told anyone of the assaults, didn't even remember them for 2 decades, never sought medical treatment, didn't change her behavior, never sought a change in unit assignment. Her own records do not verify any of those markers that you indicated. She also conceded that she actually extended her stay in the April 2013 board hearing. She concluded her service in Germany and extended her stay after these assaults further. The board explained that she received a good conduct medal for exemplary behavior, that she received duty assignments of senior caliber for her performance. There's nothing in her own records that indicate any of the markers being met, and therefore searching through somebody else's records, especially highly sensitive information, does seem to fit the definition under Gaber v. Derwinski of a fishing expedition.
Yeah. So you're talking about the absence of behavioral effects that is mentioned in 3.304F5. Now, that rule was meant to be an expansion, correct me if I'm wrong, that would enable individuals to prove personal trauma or sexual assault in ways that generally other claimants can't prove an event or a stressor. So when you were so that it was an expansion meant to enable someone to show service connection. But when you were just elaborating a minute ago in response to Judge Davis's question, you made it sound as though the absence of behavioral effects is evidence against her. Now, can you just clarify? The behavioral effects, are they required? If they are absent, can they be used against an appellant? Was the regulation intended to be used in that way?
No, Your Honor. I was merely indicating that because her records do not show any of these markers, it's unclear just looking at her statements, especially with the credibility determination here, what other third-party records would do to fill in the blanks where she's already conceded that none of these things would be present in her records or in anybody else's records. But also to that point, 3.304F5 was an expansion to the notice requirement. It does not put any extra obligations on VA as far as obtaining records or assistance. It's purely an expansion of the notice requirement. Under 5103A, the VA is not obligated to create any new evidence other than obtaining a VA examination or obtaining a medical opinion as required. There's nothing in the statute that indicates VA would be obligated to depose people or locate people, and that certainly seems to be the case in, consistent with the court's holding in Lam v. Shinseki, also indicating that the secretary is not a private investigator and is not obligated to locate people. I'd also keep in mind, Your Honor, that it's worth noting just simply looking through records on a fishing expedition basis here to see who, if it's Sergeant Thomas or Sergeant Thompson, causes a great deal of tension with VA's privacy regulations. In Faust v. West, it's clear that the adjudicator cannot look at any evidence that cannot be placed into the claims file and cannot be reviewed by the claimant. Claimant has the right to see all evidence considered in weighing and adjudicating the claim. So even just an adjudicator looking through other veterans' records to assess the relevancy or trying to identify who it may be from specific names that she may have identified would clearly not be warranted under the duty to assist and causes a great deal of concern as to the third-party privacy interests.
Now, the GC opinion advises that VBA should consider issuing regulations or establishing uniform procedures to address the unique and sensitive issues that are relevant to these kinds of claims. Has VA done so? Is any effort underway to establish these procedures given the ever-increasing number of sexual assault claims?
No, Your Honor. Right now, I submitted to the court, there's been an update to this GC opinion. There's been a lot of questions from the agency, specifically from the board, as to when this reasonableness prong would be triggered, what kind of factors would the board have to consider. This is still more in the question phase, and that GC opinion was clarified to explain that when that third prong is triggered, when hypothetically if we consider a claimant has identified third-party records and has demonstrated that it may raise a reasonable possibility of substantiating his or her claim, the reasonable prong is then triggered, and the board is to, or the fact finder, is to consider various factors as to whether efforts would be within the scope of reasonableness. Now, those things first look as to who is the custodian of the records. If some other agency is the custodian, say DOD, for example, all VA can really do is ask DOD to look at their own privacy statutes as well as the Privacy Act and ascertain if these records can be released to VA for these purposes. If VA is the custodian of the records, VA has the only potential exception under the Privacy Act that applies within the context of a disability claim is if that third party were to provide his or her consent to release those records to the claimant. In that case, the GC opinion identifies various factors that VA should weigh, such as the third party's privacy interests, the likelihood that consent would be given, the likelihood that the records exist, the likelihood that even reaching out to that third party would cause a safety or a conflict concern. Those factors are outlined on page 3, paragraph 4. Again, this is all in the context of those first two prongs first being met, and then the VA assessing whether reasonable efforts would include reaching out to a third party to obtain consent. The GC opinion also explains that in a context such as this, where the third party is an accused assailant, it is highly unlikely that such a third party would provide his consent, and it is more likely that even reaching out to that third party would cause a problem or a safety concern. And that's explained in GC opinion, page 12, paragraph 16. And that certainly appears to be the case here.
But wait, and I lost track of what you were saying there for a second, so excuse me if you already addressed this. But so let's say you don't want to ask the alleged attacker to open up his or her records. Isn't a court order another possibility?
Yes, Your Honor, a court order is another exception under the Privacy Act. The GC opinion indicates that the secretary would not have standing to obtain such a court order. So that's why, with regard to when the claim is before the agency, the only applicable exception in that context is reaching out to the third party and obtaining consent. And the GC opinion explains that in such a scenario, it's typically outside the scope of reasonable efforts to reach out to a third-party assailant and ask for consent because of these safety concerns. Again, this is all in the context of those first two prongs being met, which, again, in this circumstance has not been triggered here.
Counsel, doesn't it gain some ground to have it determined whether or not initially the names that were mentioned actually exist? Wouldn't that be a limited step, and isn't that consistent with cases like Forcier and Patton? And I wonder, you're citing Lamb for the proposition that the secretary is not obligated to locate people, but that seems to be in direct conflict with cases like Patton and Forcier, where those cases say that the 5103 does encompass the ability to identify individuals.
Even if that's the case, Your Honor, there is still an umbrella of credibility that would be over the prongs of
right.
the duty to assist. And in this case, that credibility is lacking.
Well, and that's, you know, I pursued that line of questioning with appellant's counsel. I think that's a very good point. And throughout all of the credibility determinations, which I referred to earlier, I still did not see the board say that the claim was inherently incredible and noticeably absent from the board's decision is any discussion regarding the names of the individuals that the appellant indicated, which would be an analysis that would be consistent with the general counsel's guidance in the opinion. And it troubles me that in the face of all the credibility issues here, the board decided not to talk about the most glaring allegation regarding the potential of having not only the attackers identified, but other witnesses that may have been at the scene.
Well, as you know, Your Honor, the court precedence that it indicates, Newhouse v. Nicholson, the board need not address every single piece of evidence that's in the claims file. Keep in mind that these names were provided in a duplicative statement in November of 2005, with the exception of the date of the actual assault. That was inconsistent. The board explained that these inconsistencies rendered all of her statements simply not credible.
Where did the board say that? Let's go to the record. Where did the board say that?
Uh, Well, at record page 17, the board says that the board is not required to accept a claimant's uncorroborated account of his or her active service experiences or the stressors if the board does not find the statements regarding the stressors to be credible, and then goes through a lengthy analysis, and then by the end explains.
I want the quote, counsel.
Sorry, again?
I want the quote.
Okay, that was the first quote. The second one.
Well, let me get to the quote.
Oh,
what
pardon me.
Page of the record are you referring to?
Record page 17.
Okay, and let's start with the paragraph. What does this paragraph start with?
The third paragraph starts with also.
Okay.
Also, the board is not required to accept a claimant's uncorroborated account of his or her active service experiences or a veteran's statements regarding his or her alleged stressors if the board does not find the statements regarding the stressors to be credible.
Okay.
And then there is a thorough analysis that follows.
Yes, it's underlined in red in my package
right
here.
And then in record page 18, the third paragraph, the appellant again, or the board again says, here the board assigns little probative weight to the veteran's statements concerning the alleged in-service personal and sexual assaults.
The veteran's reported history has been shown to be inconsistent, notwithstanding the counselor's comments that the remembrance of the traumatic events has been slow to emerge.
Correct, compared to an exaggeration of the events over time of the trauma.
Yeah, and then there's, okay. Well, I guess my point is, and I'm very familiar with these findings of the board, but perhaps the board put this in the context of corroborating stressors and not in the context of the individuals whose names were identified. But nowhere in the board's decision did the board choose to discuss the identity of the names and the board's conclusion that it thought that the appellant's allegations were not credible with respect to the names of the individuals.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor. However, those statements in and of themselves present inconsistencies that the board did address, specifically when the event occurred and how many people were there and so forth. And I see that my time is up. If I may have just 30 seconds to wrap up.
I have one more question.
Okay. You may have 30 seconds plus Judge Bartley has a question. So why don't you answer her question first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the veteran complete the typical stressor verification form? I forget what, I can see it, but I didn't see it in the record. Did she do that?
No, she chose to submit PTSD sexual stressor markers from
the markers. That was her. So that was her choice to submit that instead.
Correct. And she did that two different occasions, in November of 2005 and again in February of 2013. But the notice letter was sent to her as well as the questionnaire.
The form. Okay, got it.
You may summarize briefly.
So for the reasons mentioned today as well as pled in the Secretary's brief, the Secretary maintains that the first two prongs of the duty to assist were not satisfied and therefore there was no obligation for the Board to assess the reasonableness of obtaining third-party records in this case. At the bare minimum, the thorough credibility determination served as sufficient notice as to why further efforts were deemed futile. And for those reasons, the Secretary maintains the board decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Endo?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, the appellant would like to refer the board back to page 17 of the decision. The board, yes, it does say that it does not have to accept these uncorroborated statements. However, the reason these statements have been uncorroborated is because the board has failed to satisfy the duty to assist. In goals, the court did find that the record has to be developed to the optimum, which does include reasonable efforts, but because the names were very specific and she specifically asked, the VA had to at least respond to those requests.
Counsel, Secretary's counsel suggests that Lamigan Shinseki indicates there's no obligation to locate people. Is that consistent with your understanding of the law?
Well, Your Honor, the opponent believes that that would also be inconsistent because the presidential opinion itself admits that VA is aware that this is a duty they have and something that VA does have to at least consider, and because of that, something the board should have at least discussed, because as you, Your Honor pointed out, it's something that the board has not mentioned at any point in the decision and that VA has not addressed at any point in the claims file. So whether the duty to assist was satisfied or not, reasons the appellant is still owed those adequate reasons or bases for why the VA is not obtaining those records. In addition, appellant wants to note that we do agree that VA can sometimes get witness statements. As the OGC opinion itself notes, VA has the power to, has subpoena power. In addition, this court does not have to accept the OGC opinion as a whole, especially the updated one. Under Wanless, the deference is limited. It's only insofar as the court is persuaded by OGC's opinion itself, because there was no notice or rulemaking. So the court can decide to only give limited deference to the opinion itself. And in addition, appellant wanted to respectfully disagree with the Secretary's position that the records of these service members would not be relevant. Absolutely showing that there was a pattern of rape in this platoon, a very small platoon again, would be enough to show a pattern. No, it would not outright especially say, yes, this also happened to appellant, but it would at least be evidence that lends probative value, especially in an MST case where the appellant was part of a police unit, so it would be unreasonable to expect that she reported to anybody. And under 3.304, VA has said that there is a lower threshold and more has to be done in these especially difficult cases. So while 3.304 itself is not a duty to assist regulation, it at least shows that it's already been recognized how difficult MST cases are and that more evidence needs to be obtained and reviewed to at least lend credibility or probative value to any appellant's statements.
Counsel, would it be helpful and would it be within the scope of 5103A to identify whether or not the names that were mentioned were actually in existence, the actual people that were in the unit?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant does agree that even if the JSRC search came back and just said, yes, these nine people were all in appellant's platoon, that would at least show to the board, who found that she's always lying, that she did not lie about this because she has those names, she has the dates. Their service treatment records and personnel records could show treatment for these other women, for anybody that she struck back at, as well as indicators of behavioral changes that any witnesses might have had. I believe at least three of the witnesses were also women who this could also have happened to, since appellant does describe it specifically as an initiation ceremony, which implies...
Let's suppose that no one went to any medical facilities, no one reported any of this, so it's all happened within this wooded area. But the names were identified. What could the appellant do with the names, or what could the secretary do if, under the 5103A, if those individuals, in fact, were found to be part of the unit?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to believe that that would lend credibility to the claim as a whole that this happened, since those names would be accurate. She did not lie about those names and those people being there. As to whether they actually had anything in their treatment records, even that would help the claim because the board would have a better foundation for any credibility finding that it does make, because at this point the board's negative credibility finding doesn't include anything about these names, doesn't address that she asked the board to look into other people's records.
Do you have any position on the statement in the secretary's brief that VA would not have standing to get a court order in a particular case?
Appellant disagrees, Your Honor. VA could obtain a court order. They're not. VA is not required to obtain a court order, but it would be within VA's power to do so.
So you believe they would have standing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that could come from this court?
Yes. Any order, Your Honor, that came from this court would, of course, count as a court order, and under their own regulations, that would be enough to obtain those records. In addition, if the court instead did a reasons or bases order, VA would still have to obtain, under the duty to assist, at least the consent of individuals. And obviously, the privacy concerns are an issue, but the OGC opinion has already addressed this, and the appellant agrees. If you have consent from both the third-party members and appellant, who, of course, would give her consent, and the proper redactions are taken, then those privacy concerns are alleviated. While it is important to protect the third-party members, it's also important to make sure that members of the military who are assaulted and attacked or raped have their duty to assist satisfied so that they also are able to get some justice for what occurred to them. And if there's no further questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down to greet counsel.